Hey everybody, Michael Steele here. Welcome to the Michael Steele program. It's always good when you come into the neighborhood to spend some time with the kid. Appreciate you very much. You know that voodoo that I love you to do is the download thing. Download the podcast. It's always a lot of fun. And certainly check us out on Twitter at Michael Steele. And you'll be able to do the same with my guest, who is a really cool dude. Someone I've gotten to know and work with and have enjoyed our association. He is the executive director of the Unite America Institute and Unite America, which is a national organization that works to bridge the growing partisan divide by enacting political reforms. He also ran for the U.S. House of Representatives in 2014 when he was about 6 years old. From Pennsylvania's 10th Congressional District, and drew a lot of national attention as both the youngest candidate and the most successful independent of that cycle, garnering over 22,000 votes. Nick Troiano, welcome to the podcast, brother man.
It is good to be with you, Michael.
Listen, look at you trying to be all professional. Dude, loosen up. Come on.
You're right. It's Friday. We can relax.
It's Friday, baby. It's Friday. Now, it's great to have you, man. It really is. You have been doing a lot of great stuff in the voting space with Unite America and cross-pollinating with a number of organizations, both conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat. What's your assessment at this point? And we're going to get into some of the stuff that you've been writing on and some of the efforts that you guys have been doing specifically in the primary space. But looking at what we've seen unfold over the last few weeks, 400 plus bills across the country, 43 states, 47 states trying to enact and in some cases having enacted voter bills in response to the November elections. How are you assessing that effort, and what scares you, and actually what may be some good from some of this that you may see?
Well, I think it's scary not only what's happening, but how it's happening, in the sense that the issues of democracy itself, the rules of the game, have become polarized, where winning is all seemingly that matters these days between right. both parties. And when that becomes the case, our institutions and democracy itself begins to degrade. And so what we're making the case of is, no matter what your ideology or party is, we should all value a strong democracy that produces a government that can represent and serve all of us. And instead of fighting over who gets to have access to the ballot or how do the elections work, we should be having honest disagreements over the issues themselves. And that's the place where we'd like to get back to. But it's going to take not only pushing back against anti-voter efforts, it's going to take reforming our elections in a very proactive way too, because even before 2020, our election system is broken. Participation isn't the only thing that matters. It also matters how one's votes translate into representation and the incentives that our electoral system produces for those who get elected.
So what are some of those broken parts that you referred to? You know, I've heard people say that in a lot of forums in a lot of ways. And I always try to help folks understand what that looks like, what that means when you say the system is broken. What are elements of that breakage? What should everyday voters be looking at so that they too realize, yeah, this is kind of messed up?
Yeah, well, I would say from a high level, our government should be working to narrow our differences to solve problems in the public interest. Right. And it's doing the exact opposite right now. Our leaders are actually exaggerating our differences, not to solve problems, but to maintain and grow their own political power. Mm-hmm. That's because of the broken incentives of our system. What it takes to get elected is not what it takes to govern. And that's why Congress has such a low approval rating, under 20%, but in the last election, over 90% of them got reelected. So that's the disconnect. That's why we need to fix our electoral system, to bring into sync the idea that to get elected and to serve means to serve all the voters, not just the base of your party. And so the broken elements of our political system range from things like some voters not having access to the ballot, go to things like gerrymandering, where politicians are drawing their own districts and the voters aren't getting to select them. And what we consider to be the primary problem in our politics, which is the role that partisan primaries play in disenfranchising voters and fueling division in our system. So we need to look at this from a systems perspective, because it's the system of our elections that shape the behavior of our elected officials. It's in our country right now, we spend a lot of time focusing on who gets elected and not enough time on how they get elected.
That's so important, a distinction to note, because you remind me of me many years ago when I was a young county chairman trying to navigate the raw, brutal political space of being outnumbered here in Prince George's County, you know, by 10, 15 to 1, you know? And so you really quickly begin to assess and realize that there has to be a way to win an election around ideas. And that realization for me came we have in this county 52 municipalities. Of the 157 across the state, 52 of them are here in Prince George's County. So, you know, little counties, little municipalities, you know, as small as 50 people, to larger ones like Bowie and so forth. And what I realized when I was a county chairman, that over half of the mayors running those municipalities in a county that was decidedly Democratic were Republicans. And I sat and I started meeting with and talking with some of these elected officials. Now, they were fortunate enough to have to run in races. Our municipal races are nonpartisan, so they didn't have that baggage with them. So they really had to run races on ideas and solutions, to your earlier point about trying to, you know, government should be about bringing people on into that common ground space to, you know, fix some bigger problems. And talking to them, I realized that these ideas and these concepts do get to carry some weight if you can clear out the political baggage.
Yeah.
And so as a young chairman, I was always an admirer. And of course, growing up in Washington, D.C., as a lot of folks who listen to this podcast know, I'm a native Washingtonian. So my whole political view of the world was shaped from a very different perspective very early on, not in a partisan sense, but how do you actually carve out a space for a guy like me in a town like this, you know? And Marion Barry taught me how to do that. But the reality of it was, you ultimately have to rest on some ideas and some values. So I would always, when I would, you know, work with candidates and train them, I'd say, you know, worry less about the label. Worry more about what you're going to say to the room. And because your goal as a candidate in this congressional district or this legislative district has to be to get people not to look at your label. Because the moment they look at your label, you've lost. Because that's easy. That's easy to revert back to that. And we now see, I think, a lot of that blown up even more so, where today we call it tribalism, where the label matters more than anything else. And it sucks the life out of any political process.
Yeah. And it's become worse now than it has been in the past, because we've sorted ourselves into these two tribes in many ways, not just based on our ideology, but now based on where we live, how we worship, our education level.
Right.
And so these labels are becoming what some political scientists call mega identities, because all sorts of other identities are stacked below them. And so when people see a D or an R, they are assuming all sorts of other things about the other. And by the way, a lot of research has shown we're really bad at estimating what the other believes on all particular issues. We assume
we're awful at it.
And they actually are. And so you're right in the sense that the way out of the the problem that we are in right now in our politics is to break the binary of red versus blue, of D versus R. That doesn't necessarily mean new parties, although it could, and I think that would be a good thing, but it could also mean more competition within the parties for people of differing ideas. And that is an advantage of some of the reforms that we advocate.
Well, on that front, since you like to break things like I do, and I'm all about breaking things, if anyone followed me while I was chairman of the RNC, I was breaking the hell out of a lot of stuff, pissing off a lot of people because I wanted to kind of change the way we were doing the game. You've proposed a way to change the game. You've got a great piece in The Atlantic, and I would advise folks to check it out at theatlantic.com. Party primaries must go. And in this, you make note of the fact, you start off with the question, why did so many Republicans, 147 of them, object to the Electoral College result on January 6th? Now, most voted to overturn the election out of fear, not fear of the angry mob that had invaded the Capitol hours earlier, but fear of the voters who might threaten their reelection, specifically in their next party primary. And you go on to note a small minority of Americans decide the significant majority of our elections in partisan primaries that disenfranchise voters, distort representation, and fuel extremism on both the left and the right. And the primary problem helps explain the stunning incongruity between Congress's, as you noted, average 20% approval rating and its more 90% reelection rate. That disconnect is a part of the problem. You're calling for a complete haul, I guess, makeover of the primary process. Walk us through your thinking there. What do you pinpoint on in your piece in The Atlantic?
Well, we make the point in a new report that United America released called The Primary Problem, that in the 2020 election, we saw a record high turnout in November, over two-thirds of Americans participated. But by November, in 83% of congressional seats, the election was already over because they're so Democratic or so Republican, they were already decided in the partisan primary. Mm-hmm. And in the primaries, only 10% of eligible Americans cast ballots that effectively decided those 83% of congressional races. Not only do we have very few people participating, but they don't look or believe in things anything like the general electorate. You have more of the extreme element of both the Democratic and Republican parties that are dictating those outcomes. And so that's a primary driver of the partisanship in our system, which has been a barrier to good governance. And now mm-hmm. on January 6th, it's a threat to democracy itself if that kind of extremism has such influence in our political process. So what we advocate for is to replace party primaries with nonpartisan primaries. Instead of the Democrats and Republicans using the public election system to nominate the leaders of their tribes, instead, you use a primary process to serve the public interest, which is to take a wide candidate field and narrow it for the general election in a single ballot. So under a nonpartisan primary, the top four or five finishers would go to the general election. And in the general election, voters would have the option of ranking them.
Also, this ranked choice voting is what most people may know it as.
Yep, in the general election. It ensures whoever wins has majority support. And then the advantage of this is, one, it immediately liberates our leaders from the threat of being primaried by a small number of their voters just in their own party. And then secondly, it will allow all voters to have much more choice on their ballot between who they want to vote for. And in the general election, as we discussed before, it's no longer just one R versus one D who campaign based on their identity. It is multiple candidates who are forced to campaign on their ideas.
So a couple of things on that point. So let's play with this a little bit and sort of shape it out for folks. There are a couple of examples that we can latch onto. One is my good buddy Lisa Murkowski and her race in the United States Senate. So I want to ask you about to walk us through that as an example of this process. But then on the other side of that, California has something right similar to that. And one of the noise levels that I've picked up from Californians, and particularly Democratic Californians, who are now kind of going, they're like, oh, this is killing us, is that generally what you're finding is in the general election, it's Democrat on Democrat. And so you're not finding a lot of Republicans sort of making their way through that initial process that would result in some level of balance where, yeah, it's not Republican versus Democrat. It could be two Democrats and three Republicans, or three Democrats and two Republicans, depending on what the final number is in the general. But that's not necessarily how it's played out in a state like California. So address those two narratives around this idea of ranked choice voting or sort of the new primary system.
Yeah, so four states have nonpartisan primaries. You have Nebraska, California, Washington, and Alaska. In the first three states, they are, as you describe, top two primaries. So everyone's in the primary together. The top two finishers go to the general election. What Alaska did when voters approved a ballot campaign that United America was proud to support in 2020 was advance the top four finishers to the general election and then use ranked choice voting in the general election. So that's the distinction between those different kinds of nonpartisan primaries. Right. We think the Alaska system is an improvement because you won't necessarily get outcomes where it's just one party's candidates in the general election, as some folks, to your point, have complained about in the top two system. However, I would point out, in those districts where you get only two Democrats or two Republicans in the general, it's likely a district that will only ever elect a Democrat or Republican.
Because that's how they've been drawn, right?
Because they've been drawn like that, or more likely, our urban-rural divide has sorted voters like that.
Right.
So that actually helps produce less extreme outcomes because all the voters in the district will have a say in their representative, and it will tend to produce a less extreme candidate.
But
the Alaska system is an improvement also because of ranked choice voting in the general election. You do away with any kind of potential vote splitting. And so for independent and third party candidates, the playing field becomes more level for them. And that system, when you combine the nonpartisan primary with ranked choice voting, it's called Final Four or Final Five voting. And that's been championed by Catherine Gale and Michael Porter, who in their seminal Harvard Business School paper in 2017 mm-hmm. made the case for why we need healthy competition. Because in our country, this political duopoly has written the rules to serve itself, not the customer. And so by advancing some of these election reforms, we can get healthier competition and at the end of the day, better representation for Americans who are, as you know, very dissatisfied with the kind of representation they have today.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the founders were afraid of in the first place, was the political infrastructure overwhelming the system in a way that there would be bad or poor incentives. You'd have, you know, really sloppy outcomes. And of course, you'd have, you know, from their perspective, the mobs, the masses in charge. They use the big words, but they really wanted narrow control. And I understand that. But at the same time, in this new environment, the idea of creating greater access and greater opportunities is something that can be found in what you're proposing, because it does act as a leveler ultimately for those, you know, Green Party or some other political philosophy to at least be in the room, if not actually have a seat at the table.
Right. And I would say one other note on the founders, they were terrified of political factions, right?
Right.
John Adams said there's nothing he fears so much as the division of the Republic into two great factions. We're living the founders' worst nightmare today.
Yeah.
Luckily, in the Constitution they crafted, there was no mention of political parties, but there was a process by which states could decide the mechanisms of their elections. And so it's the Constitution that gives states like Alaska and hopefully many more states to come the ability to innovate and iterate on a election system that actually can serve the voters. I think too often we take for granted our current election system as the way it has to be and not realize that throughout our history, we've made very significant changes to our voting system, including 100 years ago, following another period of division and dysfunction in the progressive era, and now's another time to do it. We can't go back to a pre-January 6th world and imagine that that didn't happen.
Right. Right.
We are facing an existential threat of division and dysfunction in our country, and we need to respond. And these nonpartisan ideas are one way to do so.
Well, it's interesting. The political parties, and I always put this in front of groups that I talk to about voting and the process of voting in the country. And I ask them, you know, who do Democrats want to vote? And who do Republicans want to vote? And it's so funny because, of course, you know, you always get the wise asses. Oh, Republicans don't want people to vote. And, you know, Democrats, we want everyone to vote. And I laugh, I go, wrong. I said, neither party wants everyone to vote. They only want their voters to vote. And it reminds me of something that you noted in your Atlantic article. You talk about Boss Tweed and his famous quote of, I don't care who does the electing so long as I get to do the nominating. And that's really where the parties are, because they know in that nomination part, right, which is what the primary system is sort of replacing now, as we once had in this country, you know, the back rooms deciding who the nominees would be, or even the state legislators deciding who our U.S. senators would be. You now have this situation where this process has been created to substitute, replicate that sort of approach. And now you have literally elections where 12, 13, 15% of all Republicans or all Democrats who are registered to vote in a particular cycle deciding who the nominee would be. Do you think it's realistic to reform that? Do you think what we're seeing out of the five states that you mentioned, or four states that you mentioned, that there can be a trend line created here, particularly given what we saw play out in 2020, just the abject in your face, F you, this election was stolen. Oh, I'm telling you this 6 months before the election, right? You know, so it just sort of blowing up the system to create the kind of negativity and backlash that we've seen. Will people really want to move off of that into something different, or just kind of revert back to what they know?
To your point, the party establishment might not like it, depending on who's in power in what particular state, but the people do. And that's really what matters at the end of the day, because half the states have ballot initiative processes where the people can do it directly. And in the other half of the states, the people can organize to pressure the legislatures. And what gives me hope that reform can happen quickly is that we've done it before. 100 years ago, when we moved party nominations out of those smoke-filled rooms and gave voters the power, Wisconsin was the first state to do that in 1904. And within a decade, a majority of states had changed the way that they conducted their primaries. It can be the case again today. Alaska was the first state to adopt a Final Four voting system in 2020. Within this decade, wouldn't it be great if a majority of states did? We would liberate dozens of our elected leaders from the grips of party primaries and enfranchise millions of voters who don't have a voice today. You know, where I'm from in Pennsylvania, as an unaffiliated voter and independent, you don't even get to participate.
Right. Same here in Maryland. Yeah. Yeah, when I was state chairman, I opened up our Republican primary to independents, and, you know, Republicans lost their minds and independents were confused. And I did this, 20 years ago. And, you know, my thinking was at the time was very much in line with what you've written in your report, how you begin to chisel at and eventually break up the system to allow for more access, greater participation. As I argued to the party at the time, the idea of having an independent vote in our primary doesn't guarantee, but makes you feel a little bit better about them riding with you in November. Yeah. Because they've now had a chance to, you know, elect, you know, or nominate or support Nick in the primary. And if Nick is on the ballot in the general, they're going to be inclined to come back and stand with Nick in the general. So, and what was interesting about that, and again, you know, as my friends often tell me, your problem is you're like, you know, a decade ahead of where you need to be, because this is the craziest idea I've ever heard. But there was some truth to that. You know, they Marylanders weren't necessarily ready for it, but it did sort of show what could be. And for those who did participate in it, the response was, wow, this was a lot of fun. I, you know, first time I could actually vote in a primary as an independent voter. You know, when you have that kind of enthusiasm, it can't help but be contagious.
Right. And you know, I grew up working the polls for one candidate or another, and on primary election day in Pennsylvania, how dispiriting is it when an independent voter shows up to the polls and they're turned away?
Yeah.
That's not American democracy.
And it's almost likely they will not return in the fall, because they tend to walk away with such bitterness in their mouth, because they haven't a healthier view of the system than the system even has of itself at times. And that can be a little bit dispiriting when you confront the reality. Nah, baby, you can't vote now. You just show up in November. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back with Nick, I want to get into a little bit of the political impact and effects of voting and voting reforms, as well as how his proposal could withstand some of what we saw in 2020. We'll be back with Nick Troiano right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. We're talking with my buddy Nick Troiano. Nick, as I had mentioned to you earlier in the beginning, is doing some great work in the voting space. He's the executive director of Unite America and of the Unite America Foundation Institute, rather. So, Nick, one quick question before I get into some of the politics of voting. Have you guys looked at the national popular vote at all? Because you talked about, wouldn't it be great in the next 10 years to have these kind of reforms? I've talked about this. I've been involved with national popular vote for a number of years now. And, you know, folks who listen to this podcast, you've heard me kind of preach about it and what it does to sort of open up the process at the presidential level, to allow for the direct election of the president through the Electoral College and the voting process there, by allowing states to agree to enter into a compact where they commit their Electoral College votes to the winner of the national popular vote. And we're about 92, 96, somewhere in there, Electoral College votes away from implementing that in a presidential election, which our hope will be 2024. Imagine a 2024 election cycle in which candidates now have to campaign in all 50 states, mm-hmm. as opposed to the 12 battleground states. Imagine candidates having to build up towards their national popular vote, meaning a Republican is going to spend a lot of time in California to turn out the 5 million voters who don't go to the polls after 5 o'clock. Because why bother? They just called the election on the East Coast. And Democratic candidates spending a lot of time in the South to build up their numbers in those areas. Very much in part what we saw Stacey Abrams do in turning the vote around in a state like Georgia in 2020, building up those numbers. What's your thinking on aspects like that, complementary to the overarching idea? I mean, one more example of what can be done in this space?
Well, I think when our government is doing such a poor job delivering on results, it's a good time to be thinking about all kinds of reforms that might change the incentive structure of our politics.
Right.
America is more focused on reforms that can garner bipartisan support and would have a nonpartisan impact. So we focus on vote at home and independent redistricting, ranked choice voting, primary reform. And one of the ways that that intersects with the presidential election is in advocating for the use of ranked choice voting, especially in the presidential primaries. And that's because we should want a candidate to emerge from that process that can get broad support and majority support from the party, not someone in a multi-candidate race that would just get support from the largest faction and potentially be more extreme. And that's honestly what we saw in 2016 when President Trump won the primary, but he didn't win a majority of Republican primary voters.
Right.
And so in 2020, the Democratic Party used ranked choice voting in about 5 states. Republicans may be looking into it for 2024 because some states on the Republican side are actually using ranked choice voting to in their nominating processes, including in Virginia for their upcoming.
Right. No, that in Virginia.
Yeah.
How does we've got the politics of voting, which we're now seeing played out in states like Georgia and Arizona, Pennsylvania, where legislators are, I think, disincentivizing voters to participate by making it harder. There are some who would dispute that. Okay, let's have that debate, but I'm sorry. When you only have one drop box in a state for people to take their ballots, I think I'm not driving, 7 hours to go drop off a ballot, right? You know, so that's an extreme example, but a really good one in the sense of how people are sort of perceiving what's going on here. What's your take on some of these initiatives and how they may potentially impact the 22 cycle?
Well, I think that both parties probably exaggerate the impact that the other party's agenda may have on the electorate, meaning that Democrats really over-index on, say, how a voter ID requirement may depress the vote, or Republicans over-index on the idea of thinking actually making it easier to vote will bring more Democrats to the polls. The data doesn't really show either of these things to be true. And in fact, in 2020, with a dramatic increase in vote by mail, the data shows not only did mail voting wasn't itself responsible for larger turnout, it didn't really have a partisan impact in itself. So a lot of these issues carry with it a lot of politics, but not grounded in a lot of reality. What we should instead do, I hope, is both parties just focus on how to make a secure but accessible voting experience for all voters, and then worry about turning out your voters and actually campaigning on ideas. The silver lining, I think, that we've seen of late is that it's possible to do. In Kentucky, you had Democrats and Republicans come together to pass bipartisan legislation to make permanent some of the temporary adjustments to the voting system from 2020, which increased security and increased access. That's the nexus, I think, of where the focus should be. But instead, this issue, like others, has just become, too polarized, too partisan, and it's not about evidence-based policymaking.
It's gotten caught up in this whole right, progressive, left, conservative narrative. And so when you look at, for example, you're an independent, I'm a Republican, you've got, certainly in my party, the pressure now of sort of, the Freedom Caucus types, which are now Trumpified to, a certain space. And you've got most recently, they're now going from the Freedom Caucus to the America Caucus, in which they will promote Anglo-Saxon values. I don't know what the hell that is. and I don't know how you put that on a ballot. But what's happening in our politics now, particularly in the right/conservative space, where it is much more nationalistic, much more fascist in its views, very much anti-immigrant, anti-other. How does that impact when you see, voters, largely speaking, but then how does it impact those voters who we know demographically are going to be key players in future elections, meaning as more Black and Hispanics decide to participate in the process, which they clearly are, just by the numbers. I mean, Hispanics are, what, 60,000 plus Hispanics turning 18 years old every month in this country. So the math is not working if you have that kind of view that's being adopted by many in on the conservative right. How does that play out politically?
Well, I would just say that some of the most extreme elements that get a lot of airtime in our politics just isn't representative of where either party or especially where the country is at today. Again, it's representative.
Yeah, but they're driving it. They're driving the story, though.
Right. And the reason why is, again, going back to this primary problem, those are the voters that are actually determining the outcomes. Let's give an
example. So they're holding that over their heads like a sort of Damocles, right?
Right. Marjorie Taylor Greene. How much time have we spent talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Way too much.
She won less than half of the vote in her primary, but only 8% of eligible voters in her district actually supported her in the primary. So you have 8% of Georgians that voted for Marjorie Taylor Greene in the primary. Madison Cawthorn, 5% of his district of eligible voters wound up supporting him in his primary. Lauren Boebert, 19%. And so you realize that some of the most extreme elements, even of the Republican Party, are a product of some of the most extreme voters. Those voters ought to have a say, but just not a disproportionate say in our politics. And the same thing can be seen on the left, although the type of extremism is different. It's more ideological on the left than it is anti-truth or anti-democracy. But in 2018, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was elected, she won with only 5% of eligible voters in her district in the primary. And so the tail is wagging the dog in our politics. If we had a more representative system of elections, we wouldn't be getting such, I think, extreme outcomes.
So what do we do, Nick, to get there? Is it education? Is it more scary moments like threats to the ballot box that we saw in 2020? I mean, you don't want people to react and respond out of fear. You want them to react and respond out of patriotism, out of civic conviction. So what do we do? How do we combat spates of anti-voter laws that are out there, but at the same time, not fall prey to this cycle of fear and demagoguery?
Yeah, my sense is that if we channeled all of the energy that we spend fighting each other and instead focus that on fixing the system, it'd be remarkable about how much change we can make.
Right. Right.
How soon? And so every time that we're in an instance where we see something in the news or you read something on Facebook that really irritates you about the other party, realize that it's likely getting traction and airtime and influence because of our broken electoral system. And so I think we need to have the ability to transcend some of our policy divisions and ideological divisions to work together to strengthen our democracy, because we're going to have a much healthier system if we can work together doing so.
And that starts with the electoral system in many respects, because if you come clean there, the stuff that flows from that process is going to be a lot cleaner. It's going to be a lot better. It's going to be a lot less filled with angry noises and loud accusations, and more towards solutions and problem solving.
Yeah, the process matters because incentives matter. We face incentives, every day in our daily lives. So do those people whom we elect. You know, when I was studying government in 101, the first thing I was taught was, members of Congress are, quote, single-minded seekers of re-election. That's okay. Everyone wants to be able to keep their job. But what it takes to get re-elected, if that's not actually serving the public and solving problems, then we have a systems problem. And that's what we have today. So until we fix the system, I think it'd be foolish to expect any kind of different outcomes. And in fact, 7 out of the 8 last elections were all change elections, but the actual functioning of the system has only gotten worse. So instead of just changing the players in the game, we need to change the rules.
So you were a candidate in one of those elections, and what was your takeaway? as a candidate, going through the process, trying to carve out that space, again, noting that you garnered a significant amount of votes as an independent in that cycle in which you ran. So there is some value to your, you know, process. So walk us through what you thought about that, and what did you do in that to sort of create that elbow room to get those votes?
Well, what I found was what you described about the local mayors that you talked to. When I had an I next to my name as an independent, I actually found voters would listen to what I had to say, what my views were on the issues, ask me questions about that, because it wasn't being filtered through any kind of preconceived notions of what your party label said. So I found that to be a big advantage. Of course, the disadvantage is that if there's one thing both parties agree on, it's to make it very difficult for any competition. And so, you know, you have to get 2.5 times more signatures to get on the ballot. The campaign finance rules are stacked against you. The media doesn't want to cover you until the general election because you don't have a primary, et cetera, et cetera. And so the playing field was not level. But I felt good about running as an independent because in that district, which was a gerrymandered Republican district with a closed primary, but for my independent candidacy, most voters in that district wouldn't have had any other option in the general election. And so although we lost that race, I became even more convinced that we need to advance some reforms to level the playing field, because the current system just isn't serving Americans the way that it should be.
What are you guys working on as we wrap down our conversation? What are you guys working on right now at Unite America? What's in addition to the great report? And again, they can get a copy of that. Folks can download it or take a look at it where? At
yep,
your site?
UniteAmerica.org/primary problem. And you can read the report and watch a short video that we have about it. And I would encourage people who want to dig in deeper. There's a great book, Catherine Gale, I mentioned before, co-authored, called The Politics Industry, with a lot more where that came from. And so I think we have an obligation to educate ourselves and to take some action on these issues. One of the challenges that Unite America is trying to solve is that in the last election, we spent $14 billion on it, most of that money going
not Unite America by yourselves, right?
Well, correct. We as in the country spent $14 billion. And most of that money went to go to convince the other side about how awful the other party was. Only about $40 million was spent on any of the ballot campaigns for structural political reform. And so we dramatically need to ramp up investment in some of these ideas if we want to see them take root. And so Unite America is working to build a cross-partisan philanthropic community of people who might not agree on all the issues, but do agree that we need a healthy democracy. And then building a coalition of organizations that are working on these issues day to day to make some progress.
Well, I always learn a lot and have a good time working with you guys. And I highly recommend folks get involved, take responsibility for your civic engagement and get engaged, very much as Nick noted, because it's important to have folks in the room at the table as this process is getting created and pushed out, and make the commitment to this republic by being civic minded and employed, you know, with the effort to actually get elections done the right way. We've got a lot of options and choices out there, and Unite America is on the forefront of bringing them out to the public, making them available. Check out the Atlantic article where Nick walks through some of a little bit in more detail what we talked about today, and certainly check out uniteamerica.org to learn more about how you can become civically minded and active. Nick Troiano, thank you, man, for taking time and walking us through what sometimes can be a little bit nerdy, weedy process, and everyone's, oh, it's voting, but you make it very clear just how important this all very much is and how connected we really are to all of it. So thank you, man, for coming out.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for paving the way on some of these reform ideas. decades. So you've blazed the trail.
Hey, man, I'm just a brother in the room trying to make a noise. That's it, you know, trying to do my thing. But I appreciate you for sure. And I appreciate everybody taking the time to spend some moments with us in this conversation. It's always a pleasure when you do. Definitely check out Nick. Nick, what's your Twitter handle? How can folks follow you on Twitter?
It's just Nick Troiano. It's Troiano. Got to get each and every one of those Italian vowels in there.
There you go. There you go. Check out Nick on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And certainly we know, you know, I love it when you do the download thing. Give us 5-star review when you get a moment. That makes me feel all yummy inside as well. So I definitely appreciate that. But until the next time, you know what you got to do. Be safe. Wear the mask. Get the vaccine. All right. Don't want no crap from you. All right. See you all next time here at the Michael Steele Podcast. Take care.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.